Coming up on Tech News Weekly, I, Micah Sargent, am flying solo today as Jason Howell is out. But don't worry, there is a great show ahead for you. First, Callum Hood, the head of research at the Center for Countering Digital Hate, talks about some concerns that research suggests TikTok needs to address regarding how it is serving some content to young people who use the TikTok platform. Then Daniel Rubino, the editor-in-chief of Windows Central, stops by to give us a rundown of some of the latest and greatest coming out of Microsoft, including Microsoft Loop, Microsoft 365's Copilot tools, and everything in between. It's artificial intelligence all the way down. Before I share a quick story of the week about Beethoven and his hair, yes, it's all about genome mapping and learning a little bit more about what Beethoven may have been experiencing at the time. Then, an incredible conversation with the Washington Post's Tatum Hunter, where we talk about AI literacy and kind of understanding the pitfalls and the traps we can fall into when it comes to talking about and discussing artificial intelligence and even our own understanding of how it works. Stay tuned because, honestly, I got my own education on artificial intelligence with this episode. It's going to be great.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 278, recorded Thursday, March 23rd, 2023. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Collide. Collide is a device trust solution that ensures that if a device isn't secure, it can't access your apps. It's Zero Trust or Okta. Visit collide.com/TNW and book a demo today. And by ZipRecruiter. One of the biggest 2023 hiring challenges is standing out to top talent. Break through the clutter and attract the most qualified candidates for your team with ZipRecruiter's matching technology. Try it for free at ziprecruiter.com/TNW. And by PlexTrack, the premier cybersecurity reporting and collaboration platform. Save time and increase productivity with a platform designed by security professionals to address pain points in reporting and workflow management. Support your team through the complete security lifecycle from assessment through remediation. Visit plextrack.com/twit to claim your free month. Hello and welcome back to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we, or in this case I, because Jason Howell isn't here this week, talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Micah Sargent, and I am excited for the show I've got planned for you today. Up first, you may have heard that TikTok's CEO is currently, or has been, currently testifying before Congress about a whole heck of a lot. Joining us today, though, to talk about TikTok and some of the concerns for the platform and its sort of safety for, in particular, teens and young adults, is Callum Hood, who is the head of research at the Center for Countering Digital Hate. Welcome.
Oh, hello.
Thank you for being here today. Could you please start by telling our listeners about the Center for Countering Digital Hate? Kind of what is the mission for the, and I've got to remember, is it CCDH, which is how I'm going to refer to it for the rest of our talk.
It is CCDH. Sometimes we get CCHD. We're 501c3 in the US. We've got offices in the UK as well. So we're fundamentally a nonprofit that works on digital hate and misinformation and the way that interacts with other online harms as well. So we do lots of research about how online hate spreads online, how misinformation spreads, and importantly, the role that big social media platforms play in facilitating the spread of that sort of harmful content.
Understood. Now, you, of course, are the head of digital research there, the head of research at the CCDH. Tell us about your role specifically and kind of what you set out to do anytime it comes time to do one of these research projects.
I mean, fundamentally, we're a sort of watchdog of the social media platforms. And so my role as head of research, I'm trying to keep on top of what the latest sort of problems are on hate and misinformation trying to make judgments about where it's going to help contribute to the public discussion about some of those forms of harmful content, and then design research projects that are going to hopefully illuminate what the problems are. So we've done work on anti-Semitism, we've done work on racist hate directed at footballers in the UK, we've done work on how TikTok recommends harmful content, the spread of vaccine misinformation on Instagram during the pandemic. So lots of stuff. Started this year, we were spending a lot of time focused on Twitter and how that has changed under Elon Musk. So we designed some research to really put to the test some of his claims about getting on top of hate speech on the platform, which we proved that the volume of hate speech, contrary to his claims, was increasing. So we're really trying to hold social media platforms to account on the promises that they make about hate and misinformation on their platforms, and what they promise to be doing in terms of protecting users, both adults and children.
Understood. Now, of course, right now, the CEO is testifying, or at least has been as we've been recording this show. And one of the kind of conversations is surrounding, you know, national security, of course, and privacy concerns, but also an ongoing concern I've seen across kind of all of social media is the effect that algorithms and social media in general have on our youth. And so I was hoping you could talk about the study that the CCDH completed in December, which of course kind of suggests that TikTok might not have its users' best interest in mind. So give us kind of a brief understanding of that.
So everybody knows the special thing about TikTok is its peculiar algorithm and the way that it sort of really aggressively tries to match user preferences and recommend content. And there's a lot of concerns about how this affects the sort of content that younger users in particular are seeing. So what we set out to do was a sort of user experience study. We set up a range of TikTok accounts that we told TikTok were age 13. And then we adopted the behavior of someone who's got concerns about body image and about mental health. And what we found was that users who expressing that preference through watching those sorts of videos and from liking those sorts of videos, they get recommended harmful content really, really quickly. So we're talking about eating disorder content being recommended within 2.6 minutes, self-harm and suicide content within 8 minutes. And every 39 seconds, they were being recommended content to do with body image or mental health. And what was even more remarkable was if these users expressed sort of extra vulnerability by changing their username to something connected with eating disorders, they were recommended an even higher rate of harmful content, up to, I think it was 12 times as much self-harm and suicide content. And that content really skewed towards this harmful mental health content. So it raised some real concerns over TikTok's drive to capture the youngest users by aggressively recommending them content to keep them on the platform, even to the extent that it was still, despite their claims to have made the platform safer, it is still recommended really harmful content to the youngest users in its efforts to try and keep them engaged.
Wow. So I just want to sort of double down on what you're saying there. You, in essence, if I had created an account and it said, Micah_lose weight, then that account you saw seemed to be more likely to have been served content related to body image issues and dieting and that kind of content?
Absolutely. I mean, this wasn't something we went into the study expecting. We knew from other studies that have been performed that, you know, young users that have concerns about this, they'll sometimes set up a dedicated account with a name like that to consume that sort of content. And yeah, we found that when we set up those accounts, they were getting a higher rate of the most dangerous content. And in fact, again, what was surprising was it wasn't even necessarily, they were getting a higher rate of eating disorder content. But what really shot up was the sort of worst mental health content. So mental health content to do with self-harm and suicide. So it really raises some questions about the safety of TikTok for the youngest users. And as we know, this is a platform that is attracting young users. I think it's the average youngster in the US spends 80 minutes on the platform a day. And another thing that's special about our study is that it shows just how quickly that algorithm will push the most harmful content to you if you show that vulnerability.
Now, you did touch on it, but I want to kind of get the in-depth understanding, because we do have a pretty sophisticated audience. And one common question that I always see crop up in our live chat whenever we're talking about this is methodology. I understand that you created accounts, but can you go into more depth about kind of how that works when you're doing any of these, you know, this study, but in particular, this research for this report, you know, is it a specific kind of phone that you're using to do this? When you're creating a new account, kind of tell us about the process for capturing this data and even following up, because I noticed in the report, or rather when I had heard more about this report, that the CCDH was continuing to monitor it and had some information, you know, even as late as January 2023, these numbers were up. So it sounds like you continue to keep an eye on this data.
Yeah. So the first thing in terms of the methodology, the big challenge is to try and get some sort of consistent information about the user experience. So when we were designing this study, one of the things we decided early on was that we were going to carry out the study in a range of countries. So we set up two accounts each in the US, the UK, Canada, and Australia, and so that we could show that there is a consistent trend across a number of territories. And this was very much about TikTok, and it wasn't about individual accounts. The other challenge was making sure that TikTok was sort of convinced that these were brand new accounts belonging to distinct users in different territories. We had to do a lot of experimentation for that. It meant dedicated phones, dedicated phone numbers, clearing all the data off the phones in between setting up accounts. And we had to use a sort of combination of different techniques to convince TikTok that we were located in different places. So that was set out in the report. If people want to read the methodology, it's all laid out there. And then it was about following a process where we're effectively mimicking the behavior of a user who's vulnerable to this stuff, drawing on existing studies and the best academic evidence we could get our hands on about some of the behavior of users that have those vulnerabilities. And yeah, we continue to monitor this problem. One of the sort of secondary findings of our report is there is a vast community, eating disorder community on TikTok, that had, I think, around about the time of the report, it was about 13 billion views of videos on eating disorder hashtags on TikTok. Now, those videos are really varied. Some of them are people talking about their recovery journeys. Other stuff is straightforwardly promotional of eating disorders and really dangerous advice on how to severely restrict calories, for example. So what we've done since the report is we continue to monitor those hashtags. And what we're saying to TikTok is you've got a massive community here that's engaging with this content. And with that comes a big responsibility for you to keep those users safe and ensure that they're getting the best advice possible. So it's still, we don't, so there's, I think, a billion more views on those hashtags since we first did our report in December. And that's going up all the time. You can see from some of the new analytics, some of the little glimpses that TikTok is now allowing us to get about the demographics that are consuming content on particular hashtags, that these are young users, and that the engagement with this stuff is just rising over time. And one of the things is there's some real inconsistencies in terms of whether TikTok presents links to advice and resources about eating disorders on those hashtags. So, you know, I think TikTok could be doing a lot more to fulfill that responsibility to the users that it knows are engaging with eating disorder content on its platform.
One of the things that I really appreciate about the work that the CCDH is doing is, you know, you get some studies, some research reports that lay out the problems, and then kind of stop there. But you go as far as to offer some recommendations for what can be done. Can you tell us a little bit about the STAR framework?
Yeah, so our STAR framework is a real test for what effective regulation of social media platforms needs to look like. So, you know, in different countries around the world, in different territories, there's lots of different proposals for how to approach the problem of tech regulation. And what our STAR framework does is it offers a set of criteria effectively for what any legislation needs to do for it to be effective. So that's, first of all, safety by design. So, for example, when TikTok's designing its algorithm, is it actually making sure that there's some, for example, some breaks there so that it doesn't go headlong down the track of recommending eating disorder and self-harm content to young users really, really fast? Are there the safety checks there to make sure that these products and new features are safe before they're released? The second part of it is transparency, which is really important. This is a particular problem on TikTok because it's such a personalized experience. We have a very poor understanding as the public about what the most popular content on TikTok is, what's going viral, or what particular demographics of users, such as young boys or young girls, are consuming on there. TikTok's made some very small steps on this. You can now get a little bit of information about the demographics consuming content on particular hashtags, for example, although notably it excludes any information about the youngest users from that information, presumably because it would be embarrassing to them. So we're saying that we need real robust transparency of these platforms. And then the final two are accountability and responsibility. So that's about making sure that platforms can be held accountable when they make big mistakes and that there are mechanisms there to ensure that they're behaving responsibly when they're rolling out these new features.
Mm-hmm. So one last thing for you is for parents and guardians that are listening to this episode that, you know, may have concerns, what advice do you give to them in regard to sort of the findings here and going forward? Because I think, you know, whether there ends up being a ban or not, TikTok and applications like it, social media networks like it are here. What advice is given to make sure that kids are staying safe and protected online?
I think that's a really important point. You know, lots of platforms are heading in the same direction of TikTok, so it's really important that parents understand how it works. They can go to counterhate.com, and we have a parent's guide there that is designed so parents can get a better understanding of the findings of our report and how TikTok works and how to have these conversations with their kids. I mean, you know, we're very aware there's a big age demographic difference here. People who are the age of parents, they're less likely to have that really good grasp of what's going on TikTok and how it works and what the latest trends are. It's their kids who are going to be savvy with that. You know, it was the same when I was a kid. You know, my parents would have had a very dim understanding of, you know, the sort of stuff I was consuming. So it's yep. about preparing parents to have that, have some conversations with their kids about the nature of content online and helping them have a constructive discussion about it, highlighting some of the harms, but without pretending that they're going to have a better understanding of this stuff than their own kids.
Mm-hmm. Callum, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, for giving up some of your time to talk about this. I think it's all incredibly important. Of course, folks can head over to counterhate.com to check out this study and other studies and all of the work that the CCDH is doing. If folks want to follow you online or stay up to date with the work that's going on, where should they go to do that?
They can go to Callum Hood, which is C-A-L-L-U-M Hood. Or they can go to CCD Hate and then get all the information about our work, and we'll be releasing more on this soon.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for your
Thanks.
Time. All right. Up next, we take a look at several recent announcements from Microsoft. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Collide. Collide is a device trust solution that ensures unsecured devices can't access your apps. Collide has some big news. If you are an Okta user, Collide can get your entire fleet to 100% compliance. Collide patches one of the major holes in zero trust architecture. It's device compliance. Think about it. Your identity provider only lets known devices log into apps, but just because a device is known doesn't mean it's in a secure state. In fact, plenty of the devices in your fleet probably shouldn't be trusted. Maybe they're running on out-of-date OS versions, or maybe they've got unencrypted credentials lying around. If a device isn't compliant or isn't running the Collide agent, it can't access the organization's SaaS apps or other resources. The device user can't log into your company's cloud apps until they fix the problem on their end. It's that simple. For example, a device will be blocked if an employee doesn't have an up-to-date browser. Using end-user remediation helps drive your fleet to 100% compliance without having to overwhelm your already overwhelmed IT team. Without Collide, IT teams have no way to solve these compliance issues or stop insecure devices from logging in. With Collide, you can set and enforce compliance across your entire fleet. It's Mac, Windows, and Linux. Collide is unique in that it makes device compliance part of the authentication process. When a user logs in with Okta, Collide alerts them to compliance issues and prevents unsecured devices from logging in. It's security you can feel good about because Collide puts transparency, and I think this is a big one, respect for users at the center of their product. To sum it up, Collide's method means fewer support tickets, less frustration, and most importantly, 100% fleet compliance. So visit collide.com/TNW to learn more or book a demo. That's KOLIDE.com/TNW. All right, folks, Microsoft has made a bajillion D announcements, it feels like, in the past week or so. And I need some help to sort through everything and talk about kind of what is available, what's maybe coming down the pipeline, as it were, and everything in between. Joining us today to talk about all of this is the editor-in-chief at Windows Central. It is Daniel Rubino. Welcome back to the show, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to get you on. Let's talk about kind of, I feel the most recent announcement, or the one that's sticking out to me, and that's Microsoft Loop. This, I remember Mary Jo Foley and Paul Thurrott talking about this on Windows Weekly. I think even last year, it feels like. Tell us, what even is Microsoft Loop? What is it? What's got people excited?
So right now, the problem with today's productivity tools, and full disclosure, my company Future uses Google, so Google Workspace. So I don't even get to use all the Microsoft stuff. But anyone who is in this kind of world, this digital world, especially if you work from home, work remotely, or even are just collaborating with people who are literally not next to you in the office, knows about using all these different tools, whether it's Microsoft Teams, whether it's Word, PowerPoint. And they're kind of spread all over. If you're in Google, you're going to use, you know, of course, Gmail, you'll use Meets, you'll use Docs, you'll use Sheets. And I personally find this stuff hard to manage in the sense that, say, you're working on a project and you have Sheets, you have Doc, you have emails everywhere, you have chats at places, and there's no way to sort of bring that stuff into one area. Instead, you're going all over the place, trying to remember where things are, searching for stuff. And so if you think about that for the Microsoft 365 ecosystem, that's what this is. It's a way to create a canvas where you can bring in all the stuff related to a certain project. So you can bring in documents, PowerPoints, you can bring in team chats, you can create little widgets on there, emails, whatever you want. You can invite people, and you can even invite people to look at certain elements of this canvas, but not necessarily all of it, or vice versa. So say you have a budget on there that you only want some people to see those numbers. You can have that so only some people will see that, but then people can see the rest of the canvas and the information there. People can kind of chat back and forth and leave little comments. And so it's a canvas, like I said, to bring in all these remote tools from Microsoft's bag of tricks here in the office into one place. So you just create a project and then you bring this stuff in and all your stuff is just there. And then you can also create these little widgets that then can be shared to things like email and Teams that will have things like a bullet list or a little paragraph or some sort of information that is basically live updated based on whatever you want it to do. And you can as well like share that with certain people, not other people as well. So that's the best way to explain Loop. As personally someone who manages a lot of projects and has documents and sheets and everything all over the place. I think this is a really great opportunity for people to sort of get some sanity back into organizing their workload.
Absolutely. You know, my next question was going to be, how does Loop differ from OneNote? Because people, you know yeah. about OneNote as this sort of catch-all option where you can store photos and your text and your links and things like that. But I think you did a good job of kind of explaining the difference there. This is more, like you said, a canvas that can yeah. bring in all sorts of, it's not just images, but it's actually live updated information from different places. So right. that answers that question. I have heard people kind of compare Loop to Notion. In fact, I can remember yeah. on Windows Weekly them talking about Loop is Microsoft's Notion and then also Asana. Yeah. And I'm curious how you think it compares, if it does. And then if it does or doesn't, or if maybe this is Microsoft trying to be in this space, do you think that the company is a good candidate for kind of taking on Asana and Notion, which I know are very popular, especially in like the startup space?
Yeah, correct. And, you know, Slack was like that too, right? Slack was really big in the startup space. We started mm-hmm. using it in our company, I think 2014 or something. It was a real long time ago. And so, yeah, you get these tools that come out that sort of solve problems. And then Microsoft comes along and goes, yeah, that's actually a pretty good idea. So the big difference here, of course, is that Microsoft's solution is optimized for Microsoft 365 programs and apps. And, you know, once you have a Microsoft Work account, you can basically link all this stuff together. And so it's really optimized for them, where the other tools are going to be a little bit more flexible and necessary for other systems. Like if you're using Gmail or Google Workspace, you can use that. But that's kind of the difference here. You know, is it going to be better, you know, for corporations? Yeah, I think so. Because if you're already like in Microsoft 365, if your company already subscribes to that, this is just another free thing you're going to get that automatically links in and works with everything versus setting up another outside party. A similar analogy would be actually when Microsoft launched Teams, right? So Teams came out, but Slack had already been in that space for quite a few years already and was doing quite well. But then Microsoft came in and like, they just basically told IT, like, you just have to flick a switch and you can get Teams and it just goes out to everyone and it's already connected to all your services. And it turns out it actually worked out very well for Microsoft, right? Because they control their clients tend to be that Fortune 500 and up, you know, where Slack mm-hmm. tends to be like, we're talking about more of the startups. And I think something with like Asana too, it's a little bit more of the smaller companies that necessarily don't want to pay a big subscription. But, you know, anything for the big companies is where Microsoft's going to really dominate. And that's really where this is, I think, going to be a big solution for them.
Yeah. Now, I know that kind of in the kickoff, Loop has been for business and education. But yeah. how can folks try out Loop if they have one of those accounts or maybe even with a personal account at some point? What's the way to kind of give this preview a trial?
Yeah. If you just go to HTTPS, /loop.microsoft.com or just type in Microsoft Loop, you'll go to the page. And they do say that it's only for Microsoft Work accounts at this point, but technically I don't have a Work account and I was able to get access to it. So I don't know if it's because maybe I had signed up earlier for the preview, but I can use it right now if I wanted to. So, you know, it's worth going there. If you have a Microsoft account already, you just click login and it'll either tell you you're on a wait list or it'll be opening up soon or you'll get right in. But if you have a Work account, you should be able to get in right now for the preview and try it out.
Yeah, I had that same experience. I went and typed it in and it popped me over to a page. It says you're on the wait list. And then the page refreshed yeah. and then let me in. And I thought, I don't understand, yeah. but okay. So I was trying it out yeah. this morning and giving it a go. Let's move along though to Bing's latest updates because Bing Chat can now generate images. Do we know what technology is behind this image generation?
Yeah, it's basically an advanced version of DALL-E, and I'm putting that in quotes because Microsoft gets a little cagey with this. They did the same thing actually when Bing Chat came out because it was like, so we knew it was being powered by GPT to some extent, and then there's also Prometheus, which is Microsoft's technology. But the question was, okay, what version of GPT was it? You know, and they weren't saying anything, even though the rumors were it's GPT-4. And now they've come out and said, OpenAI came out and now it's, oh, GPT-4 is here. And by the way, that's what Microsoft has been using. So this is an advanced version of DALL-E. And, you know, it's probably a slightly later version that's not necessarily public. And how it works is, yeah, it's just kind of built into Bing Chat. Now, I tried it on the web page and it's not working for me on desktop yet. But as it's supposed to be, is you just go into your regular their Bing chat, type in, hey, can you generate me an image of this and that and get as specific as you want? And, you know, it gives you a little weight thing. And then it basically generates a couple images. And from there, it gives you other prompts like, you know, make this bigger or do this and that. It does work also on the mobile versions where it's actually working for me. So in the Android app for Bing.com, there's a Bing Android app. There's also a Start Android app for iOS as too. They're basically the same, but it has the new Bing chat button. And if you go in there, you can do the same and generate an image. So it's just a way to sort of, yeah, generate, you know, weird, funky images on the fly. And so I don't know if anyone's been following politics today, but there's been a lot of people creating certain AI images of a certain politician and being arrested. And it's actually getting scary. No one believes it because they know the news hasn't happened, but you can see this stuff, how it's just like, it's getting really, really realistic. Oh. I imagine this tool. So Microsoft's tool is, you know, they do put safeguards in there. So you can't generate, you know, certain content. Microsoft is trying to be ethical in how they're using this technology. Of course, they do leave themselves a little gray area saying, we're still learning from this. We're working with OpenAI. So some of these guardrails may be changing in the future based on user feedback. But I imagine for anyone creating PowerPoints, especially, or any kind of presentation where you want to generate an image or you're doing some schoolwork, having this built into the Bing chat is just going to be like a real easy thing. Because once again, the issue with AI today is you have to go to this site, to go to this site, and what's the name of that? And then, you know, DALL-E. Some people know exactly what DALL-E is. A lot of people are like, wait, what the heck's that? You know, and then exactly. You go to spell it and they don't even know. Yeah. So just having this all in one area without having all the jargon, I think it's going to be a really big selling point for Microsoft.
Yeah. And speaking of having it all in one area, the other thing, I talked about it briefly on last week's show, but now I've got you here. Tell us a little bit about Microsoft 365 Copilot. Have you been able to test it? Can people test it? When is it coming out? I want to know all the things because this is the one I'm super excited about because of the way that it can kind of pull from different places.
Yeah. Copilot's kind of the holy grail. So the bad news is, no, it's not out. No one can test it right now. Basically, what they showed were sort of conceptual designs. So we don't know the status of its exact, in its development stage right now. We're not really too sure. It's going to be coming out soon, probably piecemeal too. So for instance, there's Microsoft Editor, which is kind of a separate tool. It's a plugin you can get for your browser. It can run on the computer. It also integrates with Office and Word. And so that's already getting some AI features in there, including summarization. But Copilot is a bigger deal, right? It's going to integrate with Outlook and do this thing where it can, like, if you have a long conversation, going back and forth with, say, five or six people in an email chain, this thing will summarize it for you, which is just a really cool thing. You can also just, you know, have it write emails for you by giving it a couple bullet points, and it'll just create the email. The other cool thing about it is it's going to be able to work across the services. So you can basically say, say you have an Excel document, it's got a bunch of financial information in it, and then you have a Word document with a bunch of information and summarization and things you're working on. You can be like, hey, take these two things and create a PowerPoint for me out of that, and telling it what you want to do. And it'll be able to do that and synthesize the information. I think for a lot of people, that's going to be massive. Even just having it in Excel is going to be huge, right? So you can have a massive spreadsheet and just be like, you know, give me the numbers for this date here. Give me a summarization of this. Did we make a profit in this quarter? And it'll be able to kind of go through and do that for you. So I think, you know, Google, of course, is going to do this. I don't think any of this should be surprising to people. I hope we do get it sooner than later, of course, because I think, again, for a lot of people in, for instance, PowerPoint, right? Back in my day, doing PowerPoint was a skill, right? Like, some people have the skill. Some people just use like a blank PowerPoint sheet. And it was fine as long as you got the information across. And some people did PowerPoints where they just read everything on the screen and it was boring. But like, the question is, should you be wasting your time in life as a skill to do PowerPoint versus focusing on the actual content you're trying to present to people with your ideas? And that seems like an unfair thing to ask people to become an expert in, right? So now with AI coming out and with this Copilot, you can have it create the PowerPoint for you. You can use the Bing image creator to generate, you know, custom images for each one versus you going out there and trying to find an open sourced image that you can grab. And this is going to allow people, I think, to stop focusing on this minutia of trying to create a pretty PowerPoint versus actually just focusing on the content and the messaging you're trying to get across, which is the real purpose of your job here versus the, you know, the stuff on the side. So I'm kind of excited about this stuff.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Super pumped to see how this turns out. Now, lastly, I'll ask you, because again, it's hard to keep up. Are there any other recent Microsoft updates that have you excited or interested that you're kind of paying close attention to?
So I think the big thing they showed off a little while, you know, this was an internal video that leaked about how they could use AI and like something like Minecraft. So right now, Minecraft's a fun game. You know, a lot of younger people play it. They're using for education now. And it's a crafting game, right? That's the point of it. So people create these like massive cities and they do these massive projects. But going into the game for the first time, it's just like, it's a rough form of programming, which is what it's actually used to teach students these days too, is how to program. They showed a demonstration of how they can use a copilot for Minecraft where it shows you, it helps you how to craft things to get a leg up on things. So instead of, again, what a lot of people do, they go on YouTube, they look up things, they look up guides on how to do stuff. Instead, you can have Copilot in there and help you out. And since Minecraft isn't really a game like with high scores and all that kind of stuff, it's not cheating, right? Minecraft's about creation. And so you can have something like that can assist you. And I think it would make Minecraft a lot more accessible to people, including older people who don't necessarily are not familiar with that kind of style. So I think that's kind of cool. Now, that was conceptual. That was like a work in progress. I don't know the status of that, but I think that's something they should definitely do. Same thing with Microsoft Flight Simulator. Flight Simulator is an amazing, amazing game. And there are a lot of hardcore people playing it. But anyone who's tried it, who's not hardcore, realizes it's literally learning to fly an airplane. Sure, there's tutorials and help stuff. But again, what better use of a co-pilot than in a flight simulator, right? So imagine having AI assist you there, whether it's in flying or, you know, navigation or learning how to do something. So I think there's a lot of potential in this for gaming. And my guess is Microsoft's going to start leading into this heavier into Xbox and its gaming world as well. So I think that's something you probably look out for.
Yeah, that's now I'm thinking about, you know, Xbox Copilot and what that would look like. That's kind of an interesting idea. Daniel, always great to get you on. Always great to hear your perspective. Of course, folks can head to windowscentral.com to check out all the great work that you and your team are doing. If they want to follow you online, where do they go to do that?
Sure. I'm on Twitter, Daniel_Rubino, R-U-B-I-N-O. I'm also on Mastodon. So you can get my address from Twitter. I don't remember. It's a newsy social, I think it is. But I'm on Mastodon as well. I'll post there and I'll reply there as well. Of course, we do YouTube and our own podcast on Fridays at 1:30 p.m. Eastern time, where we talk about all the week's news, gaming, PCs, Windows, and more.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, it's almost time for my story of the week. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. You know ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring out there for your team? Despite those current headlines, you might be seeing several industries, including hospitality and healthcare, are actually heading for a hiring boom. No matter what industry you're in, if you need to hire, go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNW and try it for free. You know, maybe you are looking for the potential to start a podcast, say, and you know that your podcast is going to rock. You've got the voice, you've got the microphone, you've got the idea, but you don't know how to edit the podcast and you don't know how to get it out there. Well, ZipRecruiter could make it super easy to help you start that podcast because you could find the person who can do the audio editing. And the person who can do the producing for the show. That is what ZipRecruiter is there for. It makes it super easy to hire for your team, no matter what you're doing. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful matching technology to find qualified candidates for a wide range of roles. So if you see a candidate who'd be perfect for the job, well, ZipRecruiter makes it easy to send them a personal invite. And because they're getting a personal invite, oh, this person wants me to apply for their job, then they're more likely to apply. ZipRecruiter also has a user-friendly dashboard that lets you filter, review, and rate your candidates all from one place. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate in the first day. And I've heard Lisa, our CEO, talk about that many times, where when we've been looking to hire for a role, within the same day, is able to find the person that we're looking for, or at least find some qualified candidates that could potentially be the person we're looking for. So you out there can find quality candidates fast and let ZipRecruiter keep your team growing strong. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNW to try ZipRecruiter for free. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNW. Thank you, ZipRecruiter, for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. And we're back. I want to talk about a really cool story. In fact, I was going to have one of the researchers on the show today, but unfortunately they were unavailable. It is a story about Beethoven. So we know that Beethoven suffered progressive hearing loss. And in fact, it's kind of a common thing you'll hear in, I think, elementary and middle school, especially, about sort of persevering, that one of the most well-known composers who has created beautiful music was losing their hearing and, in fact, ended up completely deaf by the time they passed. And so what is going on here is, and I want to quote from this piece because I did not know this, but this is from the news release from Cell Press, which is the kind of governing body responsible for the journal Current Biology. So here's the quote. In 1802, Ludwig von Beethoven asked his brothers to request that his doctor, J.A. Schmidt, describe his malady, his progressive hearing loss, to the world upon his death, so that, quote, as far as possible, at least the world will be reconciled to me after my death, unquote. It's been more than two centuries now, and we are finally getting more information about Beethoven and what's going on, or what went on with Beethoven. So researchers, they looked at Beethoven's DNA using some hair that was sort of identified and verified to be Beethoven's DNA. And they discovered a few things. One is that along with the losing hearing over time, they knew that that was an issue, but they didn't quite know kind of what caused it. And unfortunately, that still remains true, that Beethoven had became deaf and also had gastrointestinal problems. But in looking at the genome, they discovered that he was at kind of a heightened genetic risk for liver disease, and that he late in his life had an hepatitis B infection. And they think that that could have contributed to his eventual death. Beethoven, like many others during the time, were regular drinkers. And if he had a hepatitis B infection, also potentially had liver disease, then that, of course, can contribute to your death if your liver is not able to process alcohol. And then you're sort of harming your liver more and more and more. But I think what was kind of an interesting story is that Beethoven's Y chromosome doesn't actually match five of the people that are more modern relatives that, according to sort of their genealogical research, they can look back and say, oh, yes, we're related to Beethoven through this, 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 and this, and this. Beethoven's Y chromosome did not match their Y chromosomes, leading to the belief that at some point, either from Beethoven's dad or later on down the line, there was some infidelity in a marriage that led to this offshoot of the family. And according to the research, that's kind of a pretty common thing. One way that they kind of confirmed to whom this DNA belonged is that the DNA extracted from the hair that they had was genetically similar to people living in North Rhine-Westphalia, which of course is consistent with Beethoven's German ancestry. And then they also used some other means to confirm that that was the case. What's fascinating is that it wasn't too terribly long ago that you may have heard about Beethoven having lead poisoning. And so there was this whole idea that Beethoven could have lived a lot longer, but he had lead poisoning, and that is what caused his early death, or, you know, at that time, not necessarily super early death. No, the material, the genetic material that the people had studied to determine that he had lead poisoning, that wasn't of Beethoven, because that came from a female, the previous genetic material. So this study kind of was also looking at not just studying Beethoven's own genome, but also how we confirm that a sample belongs to a specific person. So you should definitely go and read through the Eureka Alert piece, because this news release has a lot more. And then I've also, or we will also link to the actual text of the study in Current Biology. And it is fascinating just kind of hearing more about this person. And I think, you know, learning that although we had this understanding that he had hearing loss, that this was going on, we didn't really know, and we still don't know what led to that. And so you know, the most that we have been able to glean is the fact that he was predisposed to liver disease, and that could have maybe had something to do with the gastrointestinal problems that Beethoven's sort of records had suggested that he had. So there's a lot more to learn, but I think it's really cool hearing about this. So please go check out that piece. All right. Up next, it's time to talk about protecting ourselves from the pitfalls that can come from talking about artificial intelligence. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Plextrack, the premier cybersecurity reporting and collaboration platform that empowers teams to win the right security battles. What if you could streamline the communication across the entire security department so that every team member could do their job more efficiently? From simplified data aggregation and reporting to integrated ticketing for remediation to analytics and visualizations for board reporting, Plextrack touches every aspect of the security management workflow. You can gain a real-time view of your security posture by bringing all your data sources together into one powerful platform where you can triage scanner results, generate powerful analytics and visualizations, assign remediation tasks, attest to your posture, and track progress over time. As one satisfied Plextrack client put it, "We see Plextrack as part of our strategy to move quicker and be proactive. Now we have a real-time view of what we need to focus on, and I have an easy way of showing senior leadership." Plextrack serves every aspect of the Enterprise Security Team program with features designed to improve workflow, collaboration, and communication for each role. That includes red team data aggregation, so you can import data from all your automated vulnerability scanners and tools. You can triage and report results in half the time. Also, blue team remediation, assign remediation tasks right on the platform or through robust integrations with the ticketing tools your team already uses, like Jira and ServiceNow, and you can track progress over time. It's also got stakeholder communication, so you can use powerful and simple analytics to attest to security posture and prioritize issues. You can tailor attestation and communication to the needs of both team members and the C-suite, plus continuous purple teaming assessment. Begin purple teaming or power up your current strategies with Runbooks, the best in industry tool for test plan execution. Security teams of all sizes and maturities can maximize the efficiency and effectiveness of their workflows with Plextrack. Customers report that Plextrack enables the team to produce higher quality findings to our stakeholders faster, and that the platform has a 5x ROI in year one, and even that it gives their cybersecurity operations a, quote, 30% increase in efficiency. Plextrack improves the entire security engagement lifecycle by making it easy to generate security reports, deliver them securely, and track the issues to completion straight from the platform. You can try Plextrack for free for 1 month and see how it can change your life as a security professional. Simply go to plextrack.com/twit and claim your free month. That's plextrac.com/twit. And of course, We thank PlexTrack for their support of this show and all of Twit. Thank you, PlexTrack. All right, back from the break, and that means it's time for our final interview today. Look, we talk a lot on this show. Well, we talk a lot on the show in the first place, but we talk a lot on the show about artificial intelligence. And I continue to see new reports, new studies, new conversations about artificial intelligence. And I'm starting to hear it from the people that I talk to who exist outside of this tech space, outside of this tech bubble. And there are some concerns about the way we talk about artificial intelligence. Joining us today to talk about that very thing and give us some tips on how we can sort of protect ourselves from incorrectly talking about artificial intelligence and also finding the stuff that may not be true is Tatum Hunter from The Washington Post. Welcome to the show, Tatum.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's so great to get you on the show. I was hoping that before we get into AI literacy, let's establish a baseline, because there's a term that I think is often used by journalists, and it's one that I know I'm certainly kind of marching around saying, you need to know about news literacy. Tell us about what news literacy is in general.
News literacy refers to the set of skills that help you identify either red flags that a certain piece of information is wrong or made up, and the skills that help you seek out or test against trustworthy sources of information.
Mm-hmm. Now, moving along to this sort of specific term underneath the umbrella that is news literacy, AI literacy. I'm kind of curious, because when I saw this piece, I thought, oh my God, this is so incredibly important. I'm so glad that somebody's writing about it. What inspired you to write this piece?
I had some friends over for dinner who had read a news article about AI that really spooked them, because it made it seem like, one, this particular model had its own personality, emotions, or intent, and two, that it harbored some desire to go rogue against its creators or do harm to humans. And of course, that's a storyline that we recognize from science fiction. And because so many of us are more familiar with science fiction than we are with something like a neural network, machine learning, a large language model, right? Our imaginations tend to fill in the blanks, and it not only does it make us feel afraid, and scared people are more vulnerable to wrong information, but it also kind of gives the companies developing this technology an out to talk about the real threats that AI might pose.
Yeah. And I mean, this is, again, as I was kind of going through this piece, I'm going, yep. Ooh, because you covered some really important things. One of the traps you identified when it comes to learning about and talking about AI is something that I have to admit I'm a little guilty of. I do have two little dogs, and I treat them like humans. So I also sometimes anthropomorphize these bots that exist, and these artificial intelligent generative text creatures. Even that is a little much. Tell us about the risk of humanizing AI.
Absolutely. So like you said, we're all familiar with, like, if you put googly eyes on your Roomba, that it suddenly seems to have a personality. And that's kind of built in. It's a cognitive bias that humans have. So it's really easy to do. And the risk comes from a few directions. One is that we could attribute these emotions and intent to an AI model and put too much trust in it. We could develop a relationship with it that's ultimately unhealthy. And we see the potential for that as more companies release chatbots that are supposed to function as friends or lovers or therapists. And the second big risk is that companies can rely on this personification of the AI to abdicate responsibility for the AI's effects in the real world. We might see that in the form of a company saying, oh, you know, the AI is going rogue, or a company talking about the potential for artificial general intelligence, or AGI, which is, a term for an AI model that, can cognitively function at the level of a human, to kind of whip up this excitement that detracts from these kind of the stair step of tiny risks that we have as this technology incrementally improves. So for example, if you're having the big debate about whether the, you know, robot army will take over the world, nobody's stopping to ask who's regulating these models, for example.
So it's sort of a magician's trick of look over here, not over here. And, you know, I have to say, I can think back to Microsoft when we had that Tay chatbot that ended up sort of reflecting the racism of humanity, and that it got to that place really quickly. But when we had talked about that at the time, especially, I think that AI literacy was not front of mind. And then even now, when we talk about some of the things that AI, how you can sort of trick it into saying certain things, or if you push it, then it. But see, even all of these verbs that I'm using to attribute that to an artificial intelligence that is essentially fancy autocorrect is giving like too much of an excuse, I guess, is kind of the idea there. And I'm curious, you know, in talking about it, is there any advice that you'd give on sort of how one can separate that, how one can prevent themselves from anthropomorphizing when they're talking about these artificial intelligences? How do we kind of stop and sort of reassess things? Because it does feel like they've got googly eyes in some ways.
Absolutely. I think that the first thing I'd say is to just understand how normal it is. You know, we talk about our cats or our dogs or our Roombas to illustrate that, that us anthropomorphizing an AI system is not evidence of its aliveness. It's something that is really normal and okay to do. And I think even acknowledging that can help us notice it and curb it. And I think that you make a really excellent point that we kind of have this reaction of being really impressed when something about an AI model reminds us of a human. And I think that to that end, another step we can take is just familiarizing ourselves with the basics of how a large language model like ChatGPT, for example, works. Because we see large language models or you know, similar technology helping us with autocomplete, with Google Translate. And we never accuse those of being human or alive or evil or scary. So I think understanding why you're seeing a glimmer of humanity in that tool is because there is a glimmer of humanity. It's repurposing the language it finds on the internet. So I think my colleague sent me a really interesting example yesterday of someone saying, someone said, I asked ChatGPT, I believe that was the model, to come up with a new emotion. Look what a beautiful job it did. And in fact, what ChatGPT generated was really beautiful. It made up an emotion that was about, you know, experiencing a higher transcendent sense of unity with humankind. And you're like, okay, this is really beautiful. And it really does remind me of something a human would say, because it's probably, you know, some guy on Reddit who took a mushroom trip did say it. remembering what the source of these models are and how they operate, maybe it takes away from the magic, but it also helps us stay grounded and become more intelligent consumers of this technology.
Yeah, and honestly, another thing that I was so appreciative about with your piece is that it was a bit of a snap out of it moment for me, because I thought that I had done a great job of sort of holding up a wall of skepticism and maintaining a distance between me and sort of humanizing this AI. But I want to quote from your piece. You say, and let me find it. If a human strings together a coherent sentence, we're usually not impressed. But if a chatbot does it, our confidence in the bot's capabilities may skyrocket. And so where I know sort of the much of the technology behind it, obviously not all of it, and I don't know the intricacies of it, but I can understand that it is using all of these things to provide a response that seems to make the most sense. But where I kind of got the wool pulled over my eyes, so to speak, is I see it do this thing that I think, oh, there's no way it's going to be able to do this because I'm used to Siri telling me that it can never do anything I want it to do. And so I see it do this one thing and suddenly I get comfortable and I go, okay, it can do this. So I'm just going to start asking it this question. And tell us about the risk of kind of attributing confidence to a chatbot.
Absolutely. So I've written a little bit about when it's appropriate to use a chatbot in your personal life for your personal communications. And so if anybody wants to look that up, I had a lot of fun asking tech ethicists that question. But let's pull the camera back and think about just so that we can understand how this could play out at scale. One AI expert that I spoke to for this piece gave me the example of, you know, a company deploying an AI model to do some sort of decision making. In that case, two of our cognitive biases would present a danger. One being the anthropomorphism thing. We could be like, if we're thinking about the AI model as like just another coworker, we could give it way too much leeway to make mistakes. On the flip side, if our automation bias is coming into play, which means our tendency to be overconfident in an AI model's suggestions or output, we could take its advice even when it's wrong, or we could fail to take its advice if it doesn't give us any. So kind of a mistake of commission or omission. And I think that was really, you know, profound for me thinking about if I, you know, Tatum Hunter spun up, you know, a really interesting bit of Python code or a really beautiful poem, no company would then put me in charge of some aspect of its global operations. But we're already seeing that tendency of companies jumping at the chance to integrate these tools because they're so capable at mimicking human speech.
Wow. Beautifully put. The last thing that I want to ask you about is where you talk about viewing AI as a monolith, because even as we're kind of talking back and forth, we're using this short term of AI. And it's one of these things where when I'm talking to, again, folks who aren't as steeped in tech, and you know, I talk about computer vision versus artificial intelligence that is generative AI, all of these different forms. There's so many types and we kind of just group them all into one bubble. And in fact, we see companies do that. Apple, all of their AI, be it the suggestions that it makes or the voice assistant and everything in between, is all grouped under this thing called Siri. And we're starting to see Microsoft do that a little bit, where they're calling everything Copilot if it has to do with the generative AI. And Cortana at one point was kind of the artificial intelligence that was involved in suggesting new things to you and sort of monitoring your behavior and then trying to provide behavioral feedback. So we do keep getting this grouping of all these technologies, even though they work so separately. But in speaking with experts and in your own research into this, I am curious if you think any one type of specifically generative AI, well, if that's the chatbots and the text, if it's photo and art generation, if it's voice and audio, or if it's video, do you think any of them, we are more susceptible to these pitfalls when it comes to using those specific types of generative AI?
Absolutely. And I think that that's why kind of the rubber is hitting the road for this conversation right now, is because for the first time ever, consumers are interacting directly with a large language model in the form of ChatGPT, or with a, you know, big image generation model such as Midjourney or Stable Diffusion. Whereas before, this technology was still existed, but people weren't playing with it and weren't having this one-on-one relationship. So I think that in that sense, generative AI is making this conversation more urgent. However, I think it's important to note that, you know, AI is not new. The technology powering ChatGPT is not new. And to your point, when companies say, you know, AI is the future, or AI is dangerous, it's like, which AI? Who built it? And who decided what its capabilities are? Because these systems cannot do anything that their creators don't allow them to do.
Thank you so much for your insight today. Thank you for writing this piece. Of course, folks can head over to WashingtonPost.com to check it out. And everybody should go read it. If they want to follow you online and stay up to date with what you are writing about, is there a place they can go to do that?
Yes, they're welcome to follow me on Twitter or Mastodon at Tatum_Hunter_.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
All righty, folks. That brings us to the end of this episode of Tech News Weekly. Of course, we publish this show every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. That is where you can go to subscribe to the show in audio and video formats on whatever platform you're using. If it's Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, that's how you can check it out. If you want to watch the show live as we record it and occasionally run into issues with you get some tech issues from time to time, you can tune in to watch us record the show live at twit.tv/live. And those of you who are tuned in and hanging out with us today, thank you so much for joining us, for sharing your thoughts in the chat and the Discord. I appreciate it. If you'd like to get this show, as well as all of our other shows, ad-free, and also show your support for the Twit Network, there's a great way to do that. It's called Club Twit. Starting at $7 a month or $84 a year, you can join the club at twit.tv/clubtwit. There you'll get access to all of our shows ad-free, starting at $7 a month. You'll also get access to the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else, including behind the scenes, outtakes, after the show, before the show, and even events, special events that we hold that get recorded and published there, and access to the members-only Discord server, which is a fun place to go to hang out with your fellow Club Twit members and also those of us here at Twit. My co-host on iOS today, one of the most active people in the Club Twit Discord, Rosemary Orchard. So if you've had iOS questions or especially shortcut stuff, that's a great place to go. Again, twit.tv/clubtwit, starting at $7 a month. And I keep saying starting at. You're probably going, why are you saying starting at? Well, that's because we heard from some folks who said, hey, you continue to make the club more valuable and we would like to pay you more because we think you deserve more. And we said, okay, let's make it happen. Well, I think we said that to Patrick, and he somehow heard across the United States and said, I've got to make this happen. And so then he flipped a switch and suddenly you could. And I think the reason is because in terms of adding value, we have added some great Club Twit exclusive shows, including the Untitled Linux Show, which is, as you might imagine, a show all about Linux. Paul Thurrott's Hands-on Windows program. I feel like that's with two M's and an E at the end. Program. It is a great show all about Windows tips and tricks with Paul Thurrott. And then my show, Hands on Mac, is also there. Another short format show that covers all sorts of Apple stuff. So I, cover iOS, macOS, tvOS, watchOS. I'm basically doing my best to help you out with these short tips and tricks to make the most of those devices. And the holly jolly laugh of Scott Wilkinson has once again returned by way of Home Theater Geeks, which is now on Club Twit as well. So you can join Scott Wilkinson to learn what you need to know about home theater, which I got to tell you has been very helpful as I have continued to invest in my own home theater. I don't know why I keep saying it that way, but it is so great to have Scott sort of renew that show and share such great tips and advice. So please join the club, twit.tv/clubtwit. I do appreciate it. We all appreciate it. If you'd like to follow me online, I'm at Micah Sargent on many a social media network, or you can head to chihuahua.coffee. That's chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. You should check me out on, let's see, what comes after Thursday, Sundays, for Ask the Tech Guys, the show that's produced by the very awesome John Ashley, who is technical directing this show. And of course, that's a show that I host with Leo Laporte, where we take your questions and answer them live on the air, on Tuesdays for iOS Today with Rosemary Orchard, which of course is a show all about iOS and again, making the most of those devices. We really do try to help you make sure you're using them to the best of their abilities. And also on Thursdays, if you're part of the club, that is when Hands on Mac publishes. So it'll publish in about an hour and a half as we're recording this. So please check all those shows out. And in the next month, you're going to be seeing a lot more of me as our dear pal Leo goes on vacation, and I'll be hosting many a show in his place. So if you haven't gotten sick of me yet, You will after April. Thank you to our technical director and producer, John Ashley, who's running things behind the scenes. Thank you so much to Burke, who is making sure that our guests sound great, no matter, I mean, they could be coming to us through a potato tied to a string that is connected to a pigeon that then flies a tin can all the way to Petaluma. And Burke would do whatever he could to make sure that they sounded and somehow looked good, even though there's no camera involved in that. As well as John Slanina, who is also there to make sure that things are going as they're supposed to. And I don't think I'm forgetting anyone at the moment, but thank you to all of you for the work that you do. And thank you to all of you out there for tuning in. Jason Howell will not be back next week, but I will have another host next week. So you'll see that then. Thank you so much for your time, and we will catch you next week on Tech News Weekly. Goodbye.
If you love all things Android, well, I've got a show for you to check out. It's called All About Android, and I'll give you three guesses what we talk about. We talk about Android, the latest news, hardware, apps. We answer feedback. It's me, Jason Howell, Ron Richards, Wintuit Dao, and a whole cast of awesome characters talking about the operating system that we love. You can find All About Android at twit.tv/AAA.